This is Food for Thought. Call Carol at 866-823-1077. And now, it's Food for Thought.
Good afternoon, and welcome back to the second hour of Food for Thought with Carol. And joining me today is Jeannie Lester and Tracy. We are on 107.7 WTPL in the Concord, Manchester, and Lakes region, as well as streaming all around the world on WTPLFM.com, which is powered by the Granite State Dairy Promotion. And anytime during the show, you can give us a call at 866-823-1077. We'd love to hear of a new place that may be opening up, or a new place you've eaten at, or a recipe you'd like to share, or if you just want to chat with us. Again, the number is 866-823-1077. We'd also like to welcome our live audience here to the Beacon Building in downtown Manchester. We're at 814 Elm Street. Come on down. You still have plenty of time to have some lunch over at Midtown Cafe, and you can come and watch the show. And I'd also love for you to like us on Facebook. You can go to Food for Thought with Carol. And welcome back to the second hour. And we have a great guest. I've been really excited to get them on, and we're just going to go right to it because I know he's waiting. And I'd love to welcome, for listeners out there that, you know, in the summertime, even in the wintertime, because I know my good friend June, they go on vacations in the winter up in Maine. And I'm sure you listeners, when it's Congdon's Donuts, and, I'm sure you've been by there and you probably have been there and had their unbelievable donuts. So I want to welcome Gary Leach. He is the owner of Congdon's Donuts. So welcome to Food for Thought, Gary.
Thanks, Carol. Glad to be on the show.
Yes, I'm so excited. And I've been going to Congdon's Donuts for years. And, listeners, the way that I met Gary, well, you know, other than going into there, but not knowing you, knowing who you were when I've been in there, because every time that we go, it's usually in the summertime, and the line is like just about out the door, you know, waiting for a donut. And my favorite one is the Bavarian cream. But I met Gary at an event that New England Coffee was doing just like a couple months ago at Foxwoods. And it was so great just getting to, my favorite part about it was meeting the other, restaurant owners that serve New England Coffee. And I'll never forget when, I think it was either Jim or Chris Gilbert, they're like, oh, there's the Congdon's Donuts over there. And I'm like, wait a minute, did you just say Congdon's Donuts? I was so excited to meet you guys. So
that was a fun event. I had a blast.
Wasn't it fun?
Yeah. It was great to meet all the people, for sure. I love talking to restaurateurs. They're a cool bunch of people.
We are a cool bunch of people. I mean, we're crazy.
Yes, definitely.
So for listeners out there, Gary, that have not, been to Congdon's Donuts, can you tell us, give us a little history on Congdon's? Because there
Congdon's
is quite a bit of history.
Yeah, Congdon's started in 1955 by my aunt and uncle. They passed away in an airplane crash soon after my mom and dad took over. And, down the road, they passed it on to me. Donuts is our claim to fame. We still make them the way they used to. We got 40-odd flavors. It gets really crazy July and August. Lines everywhere, which is a great thing for us. But we handle it pretty well. We move it pretty quick. Back in 2000, we added a drive-through. So we have a full-service restaurant, seats about 100, and then the full bakery, and then a drive-through.
Now, how does the drive-through work? I mean, whatever made you decide to put a drive-through on?
Of course, you're watching, all the chains of the world putting theirs on. And truthfully, what push came to shove, we had to move our sign. So I had to redesign our whole parking lot. And that was back in 2000. So within redesigning the parking lot, I'd always wanted a drive-through just to be able to squeeze one in and fit it in there. But, of course, you got to be able to drive around the whole side of the building, which we couldn't do before because there was just things in the way and whatever. But anyways, push come to shove, we finally got it approved from the town. Put sidewalks in and, kissed them all dearly, brought them lots of donuts, and they let me put one in. And so from there, drive-through is just the way of the world today, especially for folks that, in wheelchairs or any kind of, disability, moms with kids, dogs, anybody that can't really get out of the car very well or doesn't want to for a period of time. Our busiest times are when it's raining and when it's very, very cold because nobody wants to go out.
That is true. That totally makes sense.
So we kind of squeezed it in. We put actually a little addition onto the building, squeezed it in, and now we do, full service on the donut end, breakfast sandwiches. We can do, items off the menu, too. We just park them for a little bit and then ship them on out when they get done.
and then carry them out to them. Because, you know, I just opened up my third Red Arrow Diner location in Londonderry. It's just been a week. And we do have a drive-thru on it, which is brand new to us. So I may be picking your ear a little bit. But we opened up without the drive-thru to begin with. We're waiting like a week or so until we get used to, you know, used to what we're doing at the moment, because it's been pretty busy.
It brings a whole different dynamic. Because the thing about drive-thru today is that, you know, everybody, today's world, you know, you put your finger, you start tapping your finger when you push the microwave button because, you know, you want it now. You know, I haven't got 32 seconds to wait. I want it now. So you have to get really fast and, you know, limit the amount of things you put through it. We're still in our infancy as far as I'm concerned on the different things we make. You know, we don't do a full service out of there at the speed of a drive-thru. You know, we actually have space to park them off to the side. But everybody wants it now, you know, right now.
That's true. That's true. For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to Food for Thought, and we're talking with Gary Leach. He is the owner of Congdon's Donuts. They're in Wells, Maine. You can check them out on the web at congdons.com, and that's C-O-N-G-D-O-N-S.com. And they're known for their donuts, but they also have a full-serve restaurant, like Gary said. And Gary, I'd like to ask you, what do you think stands out more with your donuts versus other donuts? Like, what makes yours so...
A little independent restaurant that, you know, it's kind of gone out by the wayside. You know, pretty much all of them have closed. You know, the Dunkin's and, you know, the Honeydews and all the other chains have kind of pushed all these guys right out of business. It's too bad, too, but, you know, they're priced lower, but, you know, in my estimation, you know, the quality is lower. And, you know, you bite one of my donuts and you bite one of theirs and you'll be my customer for life, and you don't care if you ever go back to Dunkin' again. And I got Dunkin' on either side of me. One's a half a mile and the other one's 2 miles.
It's true. And, you know, I have to tell you guys, his donut, you know, it's like oh my gosh, they're just so good. The Bavarian cream is like, it's the best donut ever that I've ever had. I mean, they're, and even the plain, I like plain donuts also. I mean, the plain donut is just, it's delicious. Very, very good.
Yeah, it's just surprising how many plain donuts we sell, you know, because in today's world, that's kind of blasé and, you know, not much happening, but.
Yeah, but no, people do like, they do this. I'm sure they still dunk it in their coffee, you know?
I'm sure they do.
And is that, you had mentioned, Gary, that making donuts the way they should be made. And you know, there are a couple of different really variations of the basic donut out there. And there's one that is a more maybe cake-like, a little more dense. And then there's another that's kind of airy and a little more puffed, maybe.
Yep.
Where would the Congdon's donut fall in that? And again, it's going back to the way donuts should be made. How should they be made?
You know, we really look for that crusty, crispy exterior and then the soft interior.
We're drooling in here.
Yeah, and that's more of the cake donut. So we do a plain and chocolate version of that. And then we'll spin it off and do all the different flavors on top. Some when we put blueberries in them and cinnamon and apple, you know, to get that inside flavor. And then on the raised dough, you pretty much, your imagination is your limit as far as what you can make out of those. Again, we do all the fruits in them, all the jelly fills, all your, you know, rings as far as honey dip. And different toppings, of course, can give you different flavors. And, you know, it's kind of your creation, your dream of what you want to make today. You know, we do a few daily ones that, you know, kind of spin off the seasons, you know, fall flavors, spring flavors. You know, peppermint around the holidays. You just kind of spin it off to the season and find somebody creative that likes to dream up some stuff and let them at it.
Right, and customers like that. You know, you have to make it fresh and you got to make it new. And we actually have a caller right now that wants to talk to you about donuts. It's caller Doug. Awesome. Hi, Doug.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I can't complain. I'm happy to be listening to your show and listening to Gary. I want to tell you, my wife and I... before I lost her a few years ago, went to Wells every year. And Congdon's Donuts was a major stop. And when you've had a Congdon's Donuts, Gary's right. Dunkin' Donuts shouldn't even be there.
No kidding.
Well, amen. Thank you.
To them. And I also want to tell you this. I have coffee with people at Dunkin' Donuts on the Heights in the morning. And I told them about Congdon's. And I said, someday I'm going to go over there and get you a box of them and bring them over here. Once you have them, you won't eat Dunkin's anymore. They're just fabulous.
That's right. I agree 100%, Doug.
Nothing like it. I was driving along and I heard you yakking, and I'm sad. I thought, I gotta tell them the truth.
That
amen.
Amen.
Thank
they
you for calling in.
My pleasure. They make, just remember, they make nothing but the best. I'm going to be over there next week.
Ooh.
All right, we're open Thursday to Sunday.
I think I am, too, now. I can't wait.
Great donuts. I'll let you go so I won't keep shooting my mouth out. But Gary and that group make a fabulous donut, and they're nice people to deal with. Great people. You pay. Great, I just want to say this. You pay a little bit more, but let me tell you, when you try them, they're 100% better.
They are.
Get yeah, they give you a commercial. Wow.
And Gary, what you? I know you just talked about the hours, so that Doug knows your hours right now, because you have different hours than now from now than in the summer. So what are your hours right now?
Yeah, so we run Thursday to Sunday, November through April, and then come June we'll kick up to 7 days, open every day through September, and then September, October we actually close on Wednesday.
Okay,
just
all
give
right.
Everybody breaks. So the middle of summer we're open every day, and the winter Thursday to Sunday.
All right, good. Well, so Doug, keep that in mind.
Believe me, I've got it in mind all the time. And have a great day, and good to talk to all of you. And Gary, you make the best donut in America.
Thank you, Doug. Appreciate it.
Oh, well, Gary, that was cool.
Awesome. Truthfully, we get people telling me that stuff all the time.
Yeah.
It's so cool to be in, you know, an industry. I've been here for this many years, because this is actually our 60th year in operation.
That is
you
amazing.
You know, it's a family business. You don't see that too much today.
You're right. You are. That is exactly correct. Now, not only do you do donuts, you're also a full-serve restaurant. So let's talk about a little bit about, you know, breakfast, lunch, and dinner in the summer.
Just breakfast and lunch is us. Yeah, 6 a.m. to 3 p.m.
Okay. And what kinds of, I'm looking at your menu. I mean, it seems like you have like a full breakfast. You have lots of Eggs Benedicts and and French toast, and you know what? We actually have another caller that wants to talk to you, Gary. I think
awesome.
You're more popular than I am.
Awesome. Cool.
Hold on, Gary. Hi, Kevin from New Boston. How are you?
Not bad, and I don't mind talking to you too. But since you have Gary on, I'll gonna echo. I think it's Don, the prior caller. They got great donuts. My sister-in-law lives in Wells during the summertime, and. They made sure that we stopped in there, and their donuts, I don't think they could put a dozen of their donuts in a Dunkin' Donuts box.
I don't think so.
You're right. There's no way. I think probably 6 of them would fit in there.
Right. They're big. So, I mean, just, you know, so if someone wants to compare prices or whatever, you're going to get a lot more for the money from Gary's Donuts here.
From Congdon's.
But I do want to ask, where does the name come from?
It's actually, my aunt and uncle, her name was Herb and Bev Brooks. So this is my mother's brother, is the one that kind of got Congdon's up and running. Her mother, Beverly, last name was Congdon's. They were actually from Colbert, New Hampshire.
Wow.
And Nana's the one that first came up with the recipe. She was an old school girl cook that just came and knew how to do everything, and she was kind of the backbone of the operation. When Herb and Bev got to find a piece of property in Wells to actually move the donut production to, they opened up the roadside stand in 55. But she'd already had this recipe down back then. So Colebrook, New Hampshire is where the Congdon name came from.
That is cool.
They all good thing. All good things come from New Hampshire then.
You know?
That's right.
You're right.
But I will say also for the regular meals, good portion, you know. They're not just selling donuts and selling cheap food. The food is good, too. So,
Thank you.
Put that plug in for you.
God bless you. Thanks.
Thank you, Kevin.
I've never met Gary. If he were to walk up to me right now, I wouldn't even recognize him. So I just want to say I've been there a couple times, got some great pictures on the wall, and just a really good atmosphere there.
Awesome.
Good.
Take care.
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you. All right. Well, Gary,
wow.
My gosh, that was great.
That's cool.
That was very cool. And, you know, I just want to thank you for calling in. And I think we're going to hear from Congdon's again next week. We're going to try and do a little donut segment. So,
Awesome.
And I would like to hear about something next week, because I was going to ask and we didn't have time. I definitely want to hear next week about chocolate covered bacon.
Ooh. That's another one. I belong to our independent restaurant group. And they were talking about chocolate-covered bacon in the group, and I thought, oh, my gosh, I bet I could not only have that, but serve that as a, as a snack, and we sell a ton of those. It's awesome. Yeah, excellent
Actually,
food.
You could even, I mean, think about a, like a, you know, kind of like the Bavarian cream without, maybe like a chocolate frosted donut.
Yeah, we've
like
actually sprinkled it on top, too, because it's a different type of chocolate. It's a,
right.
What do you call it, melting or dipping chocolate.
Like a ganache chocolate,
yeah, right?
Right. So you could almost do one about that. Yeah. With that, I'm thinking about that as I'm
all the gears are turning.
All right. Well, we are going to talk to you next week, Gary.
Great.
You or Jamie or you know, whichever from Congdon's.
Okay.
But thank you for calling in. Thank you.
No, thanks.
All right.
Take care.
All right. You are listening to Food for Thought. We are live at the Beacon Building right in downtown Manchester. And we're going to go on a short break. And when we come back, we are going to be in studio with the John Clayton. I don't even know how to introduce him because he's like, I mean, everybody in New Hampshire knows him. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Food for Thought returns after these messages on 107.7 The Pulse.
Welcome back to Food for Thought. We are live at the Beacon Building at 814 Elm Street, and you still have plenty of time to come and have lunch over at Midtown Cafe and come and watch the show. And you can give us a call at any time, 866-823-1077. I mean, Gary got a couple calls last segment.
I sense this little bit of competition Carol.
Really?
It's bringing out that side. Yeah.
So if you want to give us a call, 866-823-1077. We have John Clayton in the house. So I want to welcome John Clayton
Good
to Food for Thought.
Ladies. Thank you for having me.
So nice to have you.
Yes.
Who else is sitting in a room surrounded by three beautiful women?
Oh, he's good. He's good.
Listen to him. Is he flirting with us or what?
It's good culture and charm right there.
Yes.
Well, you know, I'd like to ask you a little bit. I know there are so many things that you know, not only about Manchester, but about different cities and places in New Hampshire. And, you know, I was thinking back the other day to my first experience coming from the little town of Keene to Manchester. And this was in 1984. As my father was being relocated, drove us down Elm Street. Mm-hmm. And this is the first time we'd been to Manchester. And I remember looking out the car window as we drove by what at that time was the public service building, mm-hmm. looking up and thinking, oh, a skyscraper. I've seen a skyscraper. And I was just in awe of this city because it was so different. And it's kind of crazy now because the state of New Hampshire is not that big. We're really not that removed, but for some reason we tend to kind of stay in our own little towns. But over the years, I've seen Manchester sort of evolve even from that. And even just now in these last few months, coming down Elm Street, the shops and the boutiques and the restaurants and the things that there are to do, it seems like there's a more impressive blend of culture, shopping, mm-hmm. entertainment, businesses. Have you, I guess I have two questions for you. Have you noticed that kind mm-hmm. of a change here in Manchester, a revitalization there? And then I've also heard of other cities, you know, to the north and other places, looking at Manchester as, okay, what's the formula? Mm. I mean, obviously, we have the Verizon Wireless Center. There's big sporting arenas and events that can go on. But, you know, it really makes you think, is there a formula for making a city very successful? Does it need to have a sports pavilion or a theater, things like that?
Mm. Well, just to get back to your Keene reference, when my brother went to Keene State College because he was from Manchester, mm-hmm. they called him City Slicker because he was from,
yes.
he was from the big city, you know, when he went to Keene.
Yes.
I think what you need to know is when you've hit bottom. And with Manchester, downtown Elm Street in particular, was 1991. That's when the five major banks failed. We had a terrible collapse in advertising revenues at the Union Leader, where I was employed at the time. And it was just a real low point. I actually wrote a column to the tune of 'Twas the Night Before Christmas about how desolate and deserted Elm Street was. Empty storefronts everywhere, and it was abysmal. And so you needed people who care about the city to step up and start getting involved. We have a great, rich tradition of that happening, of citizen involvement to revitalize the city. When Amos Gig went bankrupt in 1935, there were people who thought this city would die because 17,000 people suddenly were without jobs. Right. And it was, again, at its lowest ebb. But a group came together and they created Amiskeag Industries, and they bought up the assets of Amiskeag, brought in new industry, including shoe shops and other textile manufacturers. And they were so successful in revitalizing the city then that the Movie Tone Newsreel Company came here and made a movie about Manchester that showed in theaters, you know, as a preview with the cartoons and everything else, called The City That Wouldn't Die. And to me, that says so much about the vitality of this place mm-hmm. and the people who call it home, that 1991 was a similar low ebb. And so everybody got together and figured out, what can we do to recruit new businesses to come to the city? A lot of those buildings were open. The rents were too high. So ultimately, when the banks foreclosed on them, the rents came down. So a restaurant like the Black Brimmer, which is no longer with us, was able to open and bring nightlife to downtown. They had live music every night. And that was a pillar of that. And from that,
did they open up back then?
They opened up in just after 91, 92.
Really?
Yeah, it was that long ago.
So they were there a long
yeah.
time. Okay.
A great run. So all of a sudden you have a little bit of a cultural hub. Then the Verizon opened, and now you have sports and culture both in the same place. The baseball team came here. So you just had a revolution of things going on. Certainly individuals like Dean Kamen have done a great deal mm-hmm. to draw attention to this place and bring people to this place. And when they get here, guess what? They like it, and they stay. And now we're revitalized not just by the people who known and loved and cherished this place for a long time, but new blood is coming in, younger people are coming in. That's where the art session comes. The New Hampshire Institute of Art has been a huge boon mm-hmm. to downtown Manchester. I used to keep my boat up in Portland, Maine, and I'm looking at Carol's hair. And I always told myself, I know I'm in a great place when I see kids walking around with purple hair.
Yes.
You know, there's that artistic component that's been sure. brought to downtown, too. And it's just, sure. it all comes full circle, and now it's feeding upon itself. Mm-hmm. And so what's the formula? You got to hit bottom before you can climb up. The trick is knowing when you've hit the
when
bottom.
You're it's true. It's
when
true.
The five major banks fail and all of a sudden guys with cowboy hats are walking around downtown, all the Texas guys from the banking industry, you know you've hit the bottom. So we climbed up from that.
And as far as, what is your opinion? I mean, when you go downtown right now, you know, speaking of the big change, the dining has just changed tremendously.
Amazing.
I mean, it's like people call it like the dining mecca of... You know, of the state.
I used to keep my boat up in Portland, and that's what Portland was like 10 and 15 years ago. And Manchester very much emulates Portland in the diversity of the types of restaurants
mm-hmm.
we have.
Right.
It's not just steakhouses. You know, we have incredible ethnic diversity in the restaurants, which, again, I think is reflective of the community now. That ethnic diversity is something that we may have lacked for a long time. It's here now, and, again, I think we're burgeoning because of that.
Beautiful.
Is there a town that comes to your mind in New Hampshire that maybe is soon to follow a similar path, or something that maybe you kind of see dying that is ready to be a phoenix?
Littleton really? Is ready to explode. It's a great town, and I say that in part because I won an Emmy Award for a piece I did on New Hampshire Crossroads about Littleton and the grist mill and the Littleton Diner. But it is just ready to go. They've got a great health system up there, which is very important in terms of bringing residents into the community. The school system is great. The Main Street is, take a picture, it's as charming as Keene.
Oh.
It's not as wide as Keene,
yeah.
the widest Main Street in the world. But it's really a great place. And I didn't know I had a lot of fans up there until I was asked to do a book signing. And
wow.
the line was out the door at the old Littleton Bookshop.
Nice.
So I like it there.
That is fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Put your money on Littleton.
Littleton, yeah. Okay, to come back,
yep.
yeah.
And, you know, speaking of books, you know, at a book signing, let's talk about how did you start, you know, writing books? And your books are it kind of started with a series, right? Series on Manchester?
Yeah, I did. I did what a lot of newspaper columnists do is I put together a collection of my columns. And I found out about that by accident. I wrote the column for about a year, and I was somewhere at a speaking engagement, and someone came up to me and said they had cut out every column for a year and put them into a scrapbook and gave it to her sister, who'd moved away from Manchester, for a Christmas gift. And I thought, hey, what a cool idea. Maybe I can make it a little more formal and not make it a scrapbook. So I went to a publisher, put together a book with 40 of my columns, and the column was called In the City, and that was the name of the book. And the publisher said, you know, how many do you want? And I said, I don't know. I have no idea. So we settled on, I said 1,000. He said, well, for the cost of 1,000, you can get 2,000 for almost the same thing. So I got 2,000. It came out in November of 1993. And without my knowing it, I put the book out at the best possible time, because 70% of the books that are sold in a given year are in the month before Christmas for Christmas gifts.
Sure.
So I did a book signing at the Barnes & Noble on South Willow Street. And the line was out the door. I was very lucky to get a feature story in the Sunday News since I worked there. New Hampshire Public TV did a piece. The old Channel 50 did a piece. So when I did that book signing, the line was out the door. And for years, when I'd walk into Barnes & Noble, they'd say, here comes the doorman. MUR even sent a crew over because somebody called them to say, you have to see this phenomenon that's taking place, which all makes me sound very smart. But this is this is November before Christmas. The book was so popular, I was sold out before Christmas, and people were screaming at me because they could not get copies. I couldn't get them. It took another 6 weeks to turn it around. So that first book just set the tone, and it took off, and it was a happy, you know, conflagration of, you know, media. I'm relatively well-known in Manchester as a local guy, but that exposure in the media just made this book the must-have thing for Christmas. And even today, I get people who scold me because I haven't done a book lately, and they don't know what to get anybody for Christmas. So it's a nice problem to have.
It's a perfect book for someone, you know, that moves away. You know, I mean, I hear that a lot with the diner. They'll send the mugs, you know, diner mugs. So,
yeah. Well, that's what happened. In fact, a friend of mine was looking for a house out in Buffalo, and they'd have no luck looking. And so finally they walked into one house and they said, my book was on the mantle. And they wound up buying that house. And they said it was a kismet. It had to happen.
Definitely. You're listening to Food for Thought. We are live at the Beacon Building right in downtown Manchester. And we are in studio with John Clayton, historian, author, writer. We're going to go on a short break and we'll be right back.
Food for Thought returns after these messages on 107.7 The Pulse.
Welcome back to Food for Thought. We are live at the Beacon Building at 814 Elm Street, and we are in studio with John Clayton, author, writer, historian of New Hampshire, really? Right?
Yes, I guess.
I think that's a good title.
The body of my work, if you go with that.
It is. And we're talking all about like the changes on Elm Street and the changes in downtown and it becoming like a dining mecca. And I know Jeannie has a few questions for you. And then later on, I want to talk to you, too, because John is a big foodie, too. And,
we are on
Food for Thought.
We are on Food for Thought.
But go ahead, Jeannie.
Yeah, I'm intrigued, even, you know, as you were describing the process for that first book. And really, it came out of a compilation of columns that you had written. And I think there is such a thirst for not only history, there's like a blend of history and nostalgia that people really like to tap into, and it helps us feel grounded. Mm-hmm. It helps to give some permanence to the things that are and were, and even going forward. It is like a scrapbook, and having those books are so important. Once you finished that first book, and you had to be just beyond encouraged by the lines and the attention that you were getting from that book. So you're done your book. You know that people are clamoring for it. You sit back and you say to yourself, okay, I can do another one. Yeah. And then, I mean, is there some hesitation then? Because you've just produced this baby that went, you know, it exploded.
Mm-hmm.
And now, how do you top that?
Well, every writer will tell you, and I can say this from experience as well, is your second book never does as well as your first book. Okay. I don't care if you're Dan Brown or, you know, John Irving, it doesn't matter. That happens. So you accept that fact of life and go forward. In my case, I was able to switch it up a little bit. I did three Manchester books, but then my column had become so popular, they asked me to do a second column every week and not do other news stories. I wasn't a reporter anymore. I was just a columnist, which was a great luxury. And from that, they said, make your second column about anywhere else in New Hampshire. It coincided with my being asked to host a TV program called New Hampshire Crossroads on public television. That was a magazine show in which we would literally go all over New Hampshire and tell stories. And that went hand in glove with my doing the New Hampshire column, because I could actually write about the things we were going to produce on the television program. So that worked out really well. So my next two books were New Hampshire books, with columns from all over the state. Because of the TV program and being on the front page of the paper so often with my picture, it was something of a phenomenon. And so the books became hugely popular throughout the state. I wasn't just branded as Manchester anymore. I was branded as New Hampshire. And that, again, was a great luxury and one that enabled me to change my formula a little bit. Then I started getting calls from publishers asking me if I would do books for them. One of them, it's a publisher out of Connecticut called Globe Pequot. The book is called You Know You're in New Hampshire When... ..
Yes.
They asked me if I could do a book, 101 Things About New Hampshire That Should Be Celebrated or Maybe Overlooked. And so the process on that was very interesting. I started making a list of the 101 things I would put in this book. And then I realized that my biggest problem, my greatest error would be an error of omission, mm-hmm. leaving something out that wasn't a part of my experience, but other people associate deeply with New Hampshire. Right. So what do I do? I have the greatest research staff in New Hampshire history. 100,000 people would read my column in a given day. So I wrote a column about writing the book. And essentially, I asked my readers the same question. What do you think about when you think about New Hampshire? What would you put in this book if you were me? And it was unbelievable. I got 300 letters, emails, postcards within a week. And a friend of mine who's also in the radio business, Laura Canoy, hosts a program on New Hampshire Public Radio called The Exchange. And she called and said, John, I love that column. You know what? It'll make a great show. Why don't you come on with me and we'll talk about your process in putting this book together? So I did. You know, you have your little secret phone and nobody can see the light, the lines. Well, all 12 lines were lit the entire hour we were on the air. Everybody calling with suggestions and ideas. So before I even wrote it, this book had also become a phenomenon. Everybody wanted to know what's going to make the cut, what's going to be in it.
Oh, my gosh, and that's so cool.
Well, I'm often asked to speak at Rotary and Kiwanis and those clubs, and that one book is the best because it's audience participation. Mm-hmm. I ask them, what do you think about, what would you put in the book if you were me? And if they say something that isn't in the book, I ask them to elaborate and explain upon it a little bit more. But if they do, if they say Daniel Webster or Carlton Fisk, I can elaborate further and tell them what I put in the book about it. So it's a great give and take. And the shameless part of it is I never leave without a pile of money in my pocket because everybody wants to buy the book before I leave. So it's a shameless author practice.
Yeah, so then how hard was it to narrow down this giant list that you ended up with?
I had like 600 things on the list by the time I was done. But what was interesting, I wonder if you can guess what the number one thing people suggested from New Hampshire, anything about New Hampshire. What's the first thing you think about
when
you think
about
it? That's exactly what it was. It had fallen 3 years earlier, but that was still the number one thing people insisted I put in the book. And so I did. Very good, Gene. Very good.
Yeah. Well, I still remember. You know, I went to one of the anniversaries of the Old Man of the Mountain falling, and it was it struck me that, first of all, there was a large crowd there. Mm-hmm. There was a bagpipe player there. There were people with flowers, and there were speeches about the spirit lives on. And so just someone who's not from New Hampshire, you're thinking it was rock. I'm not sure that there is any spirit that's living on from this rock, but it was just an interesting thing to witness. The extent to which people feel connected with that.
My daughter was in college in Pennsylvania at the time, and when kids on the campus heard about it, they actually sought her out to tell her because they sensed somehow that that would be very mm-hmm. important to someone from New Hampshire.
Right.
And it is. It remains that important to people.
Yes. Very important. Yes.
Yeah.
So that's one of those, do you remember where? No, it sounds like one of those, and don't let me cut into the food time either. It sounds like
we have plenty of time.
Those, okay. That was one of the really fun, maybe easier ones to put together. And I'm wondering, what was maybe your most challenging topic that you've covered and why?
The most challenging of my books was one that's called New Hampshire War and Peace. Mm-hmm. It's a compilation of all the military and veteran stories I had done in the course of my 25 years at the paper, 40 of them. And it was difficult because the stories are so emotional and touching even when you write them. Yeah. But when you're in the process of doing a book like that, especially an anthology, you know, the columns I choose, I've written. So I've done all the research and I've written them and I've read it. And then because you read through decide the one you pick, so you read it again. Then you send the proofs of the, you know, the columns to the publisher, and then they send you galleys and you have to read them again. Mm. And then make the corrections and they come back again. And, you know, I love my writing. I'm not being immodest, I hope. But by the time it was ready to get that book out, I was sick to death of reading those columns because I'd read them so many times.
Right.
And then September 11th happened.
Oh.
The book was scheduled to be published in November of 2001. And I couldn't read any of them without getting verklempt and emotional and caught up in it because they just touched me a different way. Mm-hmm. And that book was, that was a labor of love. And that was, to me, you know, it's like children. You're not supposed to have a favorite. Well, mm-hmm. that's my favorite because those mm-hmm. stories mean so much to me and so much to the men and women who shared their stories with me. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes they were telling me things they had not told their spouses about their experiences in the military, whether it was in a POW camp or in combat, and to know that they trusted me enough to share mm-hmm. their stories with me made that book a real special one.
Oh, how touching is that? Oh my goodness.
I received an award from the National Catholic War Veterans, their Americanism Media Award, because they'd never seen a book like that done before mm-hmm. in a particular state. So That was a real honor. They flew me out to Lansing, Michigan, and
John, you can just travel around from state to state and do that.
They said the one thing about writing a column is what you do is you sit down at the keyboard and you open a vein. You have to invest yourself emotionally in it to make it resonate with other people.
Right.
And that's why I say that one was by far the most emotional of the books I did. Among the most touching or difficult columns I did was after September 11th. We were asked to go out and find something to write about. And as a columnist, for me, it was like, go find a way to make this germane in New Hampshire. And I had no leads. I had no ideas. I had no thoughts. So what do? You go to a place where people gather. I actually left the union leader and went down to Elm Street, and I was sitting out in front of City Hall just talking to people. Did they have any connection? Did they know anybody? Were they have friends in New York? And this one fella said to me, well, I have a neighbor up on Canoonic in Goffstown who is a flight attendant, and she was supposed to be on that flight.
Wow.
But it was the first day of kindergarten. So she swapped with a coworker so she could take her kindergartner to her first day in school. But he didn't know her name.
Okay.
He said, it's like Gurr. I said, Gurr, like Tony the Tiger? Yeah, it starts with a Gurr. And I'm thinking, I can't find this person with that to go on. He said, you know, her husband's a police officer in Manchester. And he just got hurt. He was on the equine patrol, the horse patrol. And he got thrown off the horse and broke his wrist. Now I'm thinking, I can use that. I can find that. So I went back to the paper, went to our computer library, put in mounted police and broken wrist, and his name was Gerskis.
Nice.
Her name was Lauren Gerskis. They lived up on Shirley Hill Road up on top of Uncanoonic. So I got in my car, and I drove up there. As I pulled into the driveway, there was a man washing the car with a wrist cast, and he said, I know who you are, and I bet I know why you're here. Come on in. She was told not to talk about it. This is September 12th. She was told not to talk about it. And he said, but I can. So he told me the story from his perspective.
Oh,
that his wife was alive
goodness.
Because of her love for her child. And I wrote the story and, you know, cried.
Like we're all about to right now.
For 3 days.
I have shivers down my back.
That was one of those things where it's just like, I can't even fathom this.
Right.
So Betty Ong, who was killed when the first plane crashed in the World Trade Center, was her friend who was taking her shift. So she could take her son to his first day of kindergarten.
Oh.
Some days this job tears your heart out.
I mean, John right now, listeners, you can't see him, but I mean, you are very choked up right now.
Yes.
I mean, that is.
Even all these years later, after writing.
And I ran into her about a year ago. She left the airline. She went to school and she's a nurse. She wants to care for other people.
I mean, to be able to be exposed to the people's stories that otherwise no one would know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And to have those things unfold and to find out the whole picture.
That was the great challenge and the great joy of that job and doing it for 25 years. I like to think I got better at it as it went along because people were so forthcoming with me. And, you know, it's funny, you know, guys like Mike Barnicle, who used to write for The Globe, would get hate mail. You know, he was write disparaging things about women from New Hampshire and, you know, get a kick out of being a wise guy like that. Well, I never wanted to do that. I wanted to be like they gave me a big tent and I wanted everybody to come under and play with me. So that's why I always put the names in bold face. So if your name was in it, you would know. And I loved it when I would get a call from somebody whose name I put in the column without telling them it was going in because they get deluged with phone calls. Apparently it became the very in thing to have your name in my column, which was funny.
Totally. Are you kidding?
It was shameless because, you know, what do you do when you get a group picture? And you're in it. You look for yourself, right? When you get the phone back, you look for your name.
Right.
Well, people would look for their names in my column in that same way. So, a shameless way to develop a cult following is surprise people by putting their name in. And when the phone rings at 5 o'clock and it's friends calling, tell them, hey, you're in Clayton's column today. Then the terror, for what? What did I do?
For good or for bad?
Yeah. So that was always, again, a great joy for me was to have people acknowledge having been in it. Or, you know, in my last book, The Dedication to My Wife and Daughter said, with thanks from me for never having enjoyed a meal without polite interruption. Because wherever we go, my daughter used to roll her eyes, Dad.
Because
people
would
come to
you.
Talk. And, yeah, and again, that's the beauty of it. So Manchester may be the biggest city in the state, but to me, it's still a small town, the way everybody's interconnected. The gene pool's like that deep in Manchester.
It's true.
You don't want to dive in head first.
And, you know, just to give you a little history on John and I from way back in actually May of 98, when I, the Red Arrow Diner, I chose to go smoke-free. And well, I was at this point, I was like 99% sure that I was going smoke free. And I picked up the phone. I called John. I had already done all my research and everything. And my dad, who I would always, you know, confer with, and I'd always listen to my dad. And he said, you know, Carol, I don't think that's a good idea. And I'm like, well, you know, I'm doing it. It was the first time I said I'm doing something without his, you know, his blessing. I called John and I said, John, listen, this is what I'm doing. I'm going smoke free, and it's all up to you on when I'm going smoke free. When you're going to put it in your column? And he's like, you're going smoke free? I mean, I remember you asking me all kinds of questions, and I'm like, John, I'm doing it. I'm doing it, but you're the deciding factor of when. And we picked the date, and that was the date I went smoke free. And I'll never forget that morning. I was woken up by my general manager, and it was plastered on the front page. I mean, it was this huge article. It's hanging up in the Red Arrow Diner in Manchester, and. Yeah, I mean, that was so... Oh, and there's the end of it. See how fast it goes by?
Food. Let's talk about food.
I know we didn't talk about food. Well, we have to have
that
you
means
back.
We have to have
then
you back,
yes. We're going
to
talk about food. Oh, my gosh, because John and his wife, Colleen, are definitely big foodies.
Colleen has a wine tasting at Campo tonight on Elm Street.
Ooh, nice.
Six to eight.
6 to 8 at Campo and Nautica. That's great. On Elm Street. Colleen, yes. Excellent. Okay, good. Well, you were listening to Food for Thought. We were just talking with John Clayton. Up tomorrow, we have Mike Morin, Comedy Cold Cuts, and Amy, the beekeeper. That's going to be really interesting. So we will see everybody tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Thank you, ladies.
Thank you, John. Thank you.